Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Shifts Happen. Joining me, as always, to discuss various shifts is my friend in Cleveland in the winter, Luke Grotman. Hi, mate. How are you?
I'm doing great, Grant. How are you?
I'll bet you $50 I'm warmer than you.
Well, you got more hair, so that's not probably always true, but it's definitely true now.
Well, my friend, listen, the conversation that we started at the beginning of this series was one that you and I have both talked about for a decade now almost. And we've both acknowledged that it's a really important conversation. It's an ongoing conversation, but it's just jumped so much in the kind of general coverage lately, this idea of de-dollarization. And someone sent a chart out this morning. I think it was the Daily Shot had a chart of tweets about de-dollarization and articles about de-dollarization in the media. And they've both gone through the roof, which makes sense. I get it. So I want to come back to that, and there's a bunch of other things we'll talk about later, but I want to start with this de-dollarization thing. The conversation, as I said, you and I have been having this for some time, and it's become more and more of a kind of another one of those ideas that you have to stake out a side and then defend that side from all comers, left and right. And and the thing that's bewildered me is that you can argue imminent versus inevitable, right? And that's always a fair argument to have because what's one doesn't necessarily have to be the other. But I struggle to see how it's possible to argue that this process is not actually happening now. It's not pie in the sky. It's not something that was said by a talking head or a minister somewhere in some obscure conference somewhere 10 years ago. This is actually happening, and there's plenty of data to support that. So what I struggle with is the fact that there are a lot of people that say, okay, yeah, it's happening, but it doesn't matter. And that's the bit I want to try and get a handle on, because I may be wrong, maybe it doesn't matter, but I struggle to see a way in which something as meaningful as this, once it's underway, doesn't matter.
I agree. We've been talking about it so long. It's been really interesting to watch in real time alongside you the sort of rhetorical or sort of classic progression of first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win, the famous Gandhi quote or whoever it is attributed to apocryphally, what have you. And it feels like we're in the they fight you stage, except it's not fight you, it's just then they fight. And I think there are two reasons why we're sort of seeing that. I think reason number one is there are a lot of people saying it would never happen. It's not happening. It isn't happening. And presented, what's the old say? You know, most people, when presented with the need to either change their mind or argue against the facts, they sort of get busy arguing against the facts. So I think there is an element of that we are watching in real time, including amongst some highly respected former policymakers, current policymakers, economists, et cetera. I think that's a part of it. I think the bigger part of it is that it feels a lot like a lot of us are talking past each other. Some of that is because there's some people who want to define it as black and white, right? So there is this de-dollarization, end of the dollar. I mean, if you Google de-dollarization, like half the articles are like, the dollar is the end of the dollar. And the other half are like, you know, why it's not the end of the dollar. So there's this black and white element or need to black and white. And some of that I think is because that's what gets clicks. And the reality is it's much more nuanced. And that then also leads to a whole lot of talking past each other, right? So it's not, is the dollar dying or is it not dollar dying? De-dollarization does not equal the dollar dying. Then you have people say, well, it's not dying because look at the dollar share of global financial transactions. It's as dominant as ever. You kind of go, okay, agreed. And that's why, in my opinion, it will remain the global transactional currency. Then you have the share of reserves, which the dollar share of reserves had obviously a big hubbub last week around Stephen Jen's report or note regarding a significant loss of share in FX reserves by the dollar if you adjust for currency movements. To be clear, I think share of reserves is way more important than share of transaction. That's why I've been very specific in our conversations, all my, I don't think that that was going to lose the reserve currency status. I think the system is being restructured to a system with a neutral reserve asset that floats in all currencies. I happen to think that that is gold, at least in the intervening term. And we can see treasuries losing lots of share to gold, like a lot of share over the last 8 years to gold. And now it's starting to lose share more rapidly to other sovereign bonds as well. I think also share of energy transactions is a side of this that for me is super important, is barely ever talked about by the sort of the two mainstream sides of dollar death, not dollar death. And then you get into how share of energy transactions outside the dollar or that are de-dollarized, how that plays into marginal pricing of commodities around the world, how that plays into the balance of payments interests of nations like China, of Russia, of India, of Europe, of Japan, how that plays into balance of payments interests in the United States and in the United States of the financial sector, United States industrial and Pentagon military sector. And then there's still, like, there's only been a few in the whole de-dollarization conversation at the mainstream level who are allowed to say the four-letter word, which is gold. And the fact that China opened its capital account up on a limited basis through gold 9 years ago, and nobody wants to say that within this. It's always, are their capital accounts not open? What are they going to settle in? And you can see it happening, but it's a lot of conventional economists are simply allergic to the word. They're not invited to the right parties. They can't get the Nobel if they say the word gold. So as I sit back, I go, okay, I think there's some element where it's like, uh-oh, I'm wrong. I better find other facts, or I better ignore this. But I think the bigger part is it's a much more nuanced concept than a lot of the mainstream discourse realizes or wants to realize, because it's just more fun to talk about dollar death or not dollar death.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. There's so much in there that we need to talk about, and we'll come back to gold and energy later because I think they're a pretty big part of this topic. But let's go back to that Stephen Jen article. It was published, I think, 18th of April, and Bloomberg talked about it, and they said the dollar is losing its reserve status at a faster pace than generally accepted, as many analysts have failed to account for last year's wild exchange rate moves, according to Stephen Jen. And here we get into some of the numbers. Adjusting for exchange rate movements, the dollar has lost about 11% of its market share since 2016 and double that amount since 2008. And to quote Jen directly, the dollar suffered a stunning collapse in 2022 in its market share as a reserve currency, presumably due to its muscular use of sanctions. Exceptional actions taken by the US and its allies against Russia have startled large reserve-holding currencies, most of which are emerging economies from the so-called global south, they said. Now, the chart that comes along with that, and you reprinted that in the excellent tree rings that you put out on the 23rd of the month, shows that going back to 2004, the real change in share of reserve currency transactions here. And the dollar, it's a pretty stark chart. Now, there will be people that want to interpret that chart in different ways, and that's fine. But let's talk about the reserve currency component of this first before we get on to reserve assets, because I think the distinction you make is a crucial one. And again, I don't see many people making that distinction when they decide to tackle this issue. It's all global reserve currency and nothing more. So talk about the difference between the two and how you view the two.
Sure. So most people I see engaged in this de-dollarization discussion are looking at the world through the post-1971 dollar global reserve currency structure lens, which is to say the dollar is the reserve currency and the treasury bond is the primary reserve asset. And those two are together, and there is no distinction made between the two. And so you get this question that is a very valid question. It's one of the most common questions, which is, what currency is going to replace the dollar if the dollar is being replaced as global reserve currency? And so you have to be very careful, because there's a couple straw man arguments sort of stacked up that they can, knock the hell out of right there, which is nothing's going to replace the dollar as global reserve currency. What is going to happen is we are going to separate for the first time since 1971. Not even we're going to. It is happening, to your point earlier. We are separating the global reserve currency from the global reserve asset. Dollars still being used, and you can see that in terms of the transaction numbers, which For example, in Robin Wigglesworth, I believe at the at FT highlighted, hey, it's gone from 85% to 88%. So there's actually more usage. Primary reserve asset, on the other hand, requires you to run deficits under the post 71 system. And here again is why it's nuanced and why so many people are having a hard time wrapping their minds around it, is this is their only framework. They seem to forget that from 46 to 71, the neutral reserve asset was gold. You traded in dollars, and ultimately it was gold that you settled in at a fixed rate. And that's a separate discussion, right? It was pegged to the dollar, and that's a separate discussion in terms of structure. But there was a neutral reserve asset. And that is what we're moving back to for a pretty pragmatic reason, that here too, it's not happening. Proponents get absolutely right, which is the Chinese do not want to run the deficits needed to supply the debt as the neutral reserve asset. Exactly. The Europeans do not want to run. The Japanese do not, right. The UK does not or cannot run. Okay. Yes, 100% they don't want to, because it would require them to hollow out their manufacturing bases in the way the United States has done so over the last 50 years. And that is simply politically unacceptable in those places. And it's economically unreasonable. So yeah, and that's part of the reason why there's so much confusion around this, is because when you polarize it to just black and white, each side has elements of truth. Yes, the Europeans will not, the Japanese will not, the Chinese will not, the British cannot run the deficits. That's why they're moving to a neutral reserve asset. Gold, and people say, well, that brings you to the next one. Well, gold's not big enough to settle. Well, not at this price, but you add a zero to the end of it, you put a different number in front of it, and it starts to get in the realm of being big enough. And that's where people sort of break down, which is, A, we said the four-letter word gold, but then two, in the same way, it reminds me of an aha moment I had in, call it 2004, late 2004, as home prices were like peaking and starting to roll over. Fed was starting to hike rates. And I remember I had a mentor, friend of mine in my former seat, research shop. And we did very excellent bottoms-up fundamental research at Cleveland Research Company. And he is just harping on home prices, the housing bubble is popping. And I got sick of hearing it. And I remember going, fine, okay, let's talk through this, right? Let's talk through the implication. If you're right, the U.S. consumer is going to implode. The U.S. banking system is going to come close to collapse. They're going to have to bail out everything. There's no way any of that's going to happen. And of course, the answer was exactly. And I think in the same way, when they can get people to admit, okay, you're right, no other debt is going to take the Treasury market's debt because no one wants to or can run the deficits, you're going to use gold. And they say, well, yeah, they'll say gold's not big enough. And you say, no, it'll be made big enough. And then they say, do you understand how high a gold price that implies? And it's the same way I was like, do you understand that implies the system could collapse? And the answer was, yeah, the system could collapse. And the answer here is, yeah, it means gold needs an extra zero at the back and a different curved number in front of it. And so I think that is another sort of sticking point in the mind, where it's just a lack of imagination, in the same way that I didn't have the lack of imagination initially in 2004 to go, well, yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. And so I think when you lay that out, that's the key, is you have to separate reserve currency, reserve asset, and then overlay the sides of that with, yeah, they can't run it or they won't run the deficits. And so they're going to use gold, and gold will be made big enough one way or another. And yeah, that implies a really big gold price. So, so.
Well, I mean, today you sent me an article which was in Reuters, which will surprise an awful lot of people. And the headline of the article is Yuan overtakes dollar to become most used currency in China's cross-border transactions. And the distinction made in this article is worth making, right? Because this is the first time that the yuan has overtaken the dollar in those cross-border transactions. But when you get into it, you know, cross-border payments rose to $550 billion from $434 billion a month earlier. So that's a 20% increase in a month, which is remarkable. So this isn't an anomaly. This is a deliberate push, right? Then you get into the numbers. And it says the yuan was used in 48.4% of all cross-border transactions. The dollar was down from 48.6 to 46.7. So the yuan is pretty stable. The dollar has declined. And that volume covers both the current and the capital accounts. So again, once you get into this, then you realize the distinction here, because it talks about the amount of international trade finance where the yuan is used, which is low, right? Trade finance, the share was 4.5%, while the dollar accounts for 83.71%. So once you get into the distinctions here, you start to understand the nuance of this, because it's fine to have to trade in this stuff and you need dollars to trade in and there will be a lot of dollar payers. But what do they do with those dollars once they take them in? And that's where the crux of this lies. Previously, it was treasuries and now it's increasingly gold and it's going to be additional currencies. You know, some of the deals that they've signed with the Saudis and the Turks and the Iranians and stuff, these things have been happening. There's one a week, two a week lately of these cross-border deals done. And that, I think, is the piece of this that people don't understand. It's fine to do this trade, but what are you going to hold the proceeds in? What are you going to hold your reserves in? And it comes back to gold. So talk a little about when you said that they've opened a capital account on a limited basis through gold. You've written about this literally for a decade now. I did a presentation which was built around your work back in 2014, maybe. And then it was just kind of a twinkle in your eye and those of the safe guys in Beijing. But talk a little bit about how that works, because there will be people who've listened to us and don't maybe quite understand how it works.
When I say it's open on a limited basis, their capital account is open on a limited basis. Let's take a step back for the listeners. And capital account is your current account, capital account. So if you're going to run a trade deficit, you've got to run a capital account surplus. So basically, you have to allow flow of funds back into your financial assets is what that is. So when you say you have an open capital account, you are openly allowing the flow of funds back into your country. Foreign ownership of your domestic assets is a way to think about it. And China does not allow that, which is correct. Only on a limited basis. It's very regulated. It is not open. When I say they opened the capital account on a limited basis through gold in 2014, they opened the Shanghai Gold Exchange International Board in fall of 2014, pricing gold in yuan, and it basically allows a recycling of offshore yuan into gold to be able to be taken away from Shanghai. Now, historically, gold was not allowed to be exported out of mainland China. And it's important to note, because this corrects two mistakes the American system with a neutral reserve asset using gold had. The Americans made two mistakes in Bretton Woods 46 to 71. Number one, they pegged the price of gold to the dollar, which, and all pegs break, number one. And then number two, they set it up so they would have to settle American deficits with American gold. So when we fast forward to 71, Vietnam, guns and butter, we ran out of gold. At $35 an ounce, we raised it to 42. We still ran out of gold. We closed the gold window. Fast forward to 2014, the Chinese reopened the gold window in Shanghai. But, and here's the two key distinctions. Number one, the gold price floats in yuan and in all currencies, number one. And number two, they don't use mainland China gold to settle. If you show up with yuan there, it's not going to come from mainland China. It's going to come from elsewhere in the world. As a practical matter, that's London, India, maybe to a lesser extent, New York, other financial capitals. Same thing. And they then proceeded to set up these yuan clearing arrangements in Dubai, also where there's a gold exchange. London is one of the biggest yuan clearing. London's for centuries has been the gold capital of the world. Hong Kong, same thing, linked to Shanghai. And then again, and I would say those are really the four biggest: Shanghai International Board, Hong Kong, Dubai, London. You can take offshore yuan, and if you want, you buy gold with it. And you can take it away. You can reserve it as your reserve asset. It floats in yuan. What's interesting is if you look at the price of gold in yuan going back 15 years on a 200-day moving average, it is, you know, a good friend of mine says, Luke, this is the highest sharp ratio expression on the board, and nobody has it on except China, because it is like a 45-degree angle. And so when you look at a 45-degree angle up and to the right, the price of gold is very predictably rising in yuan over time as more yuan is being recycled into gold, presumably, in terms of a secular driver. And when you take a step back to realize what that says, so the American deal since 71 has been, it's our currency, but it's your problem, right? If we print money, whatever, you lose money in real basis on your bonds. The Chinese offer, on the other hand, is it's our currency and it's our problem. In other words, you hold gold, gold is going to go up over time against the yuan, which means you can then reconvert to yuan and buy more Chinese goods with it. It's a very virtuous cycle system as opposed to one that requires stealing the real purchasing power of your trade partners over time to finance wars and more wars and more wars and entitlements as we've been running. So for a lot of places around the world, it's got to be pretty attractive. So open the capital account on a limited basis to do this. And it seems to be moving in that direction.
Now, my mate Chris Wood at Jefferies out in Hong Kong, ex of CLSA, writes a note called Greed and Fear, which is required reading for anybody in the Asian markets for a couple of decades now. And Chris is a phenomenal writer, great analyst, a former journalist. You know, he really knows his stuff. And he put out a piece beginning of this month, which I thought was really interesting. I want to read a quote from this too. He's talking about Saudi and China summits and Xi's visit to Riyadh back in December. He says, clearly it makes no sense for either side to be too specific for fear of gratuitously provoking Washington. But the days of the petrodollar surely look numbered. Greed and Fear heard one interesting rumor when in China recently that Saudi was using the renminbi it was receiving for oil to buy gold on the Shanghai Exchange. China launched in 2018 renminbi-denominated oil futures contract on the Shanghai International Energy Exchange, and the renminbi has been fully convertible into gold on exchanges in Shanghai and Hong Kong since 2017. Now, that's the first time I've seen anybody, let alone anybody as credible as Chris Wood, talk about this dynamic outside you and a couple of other real kind of fringe thinkers in the market. So I found that very interesting that Chris would have heard that whilst in China, particularly.
Yeah, and I think it's a really important point. I agree 100% that, I mean, when I someone put it in front of me and I've got, I don't know Chris, but I know a lot of people who know Chris. And very quickly, the credibility of which you just spoke came through in spades. People said the same thing. Like, wow, this isn't something he's just flipping out there speculating about. He's hearing it. And I think it ties into another critical point when you look back as it relates to the capital account opening on a limited basis, and this point we started with, which is the black and white, is it happening, is it not? And one of the arguments you hear is, well, who's going to hold you on? And who's going to accept you on? And here too, if you just take that at face value, okay. But when you dig just a layer deeper, you realize you have to ask a question. The question is, who runs a surplus against China? This is China's not like America, where America runs a deficit against everybody, right? China doesn't run a deficit against everybody. China runs a deficit, broadly speaking, against two trade categories. They run deficits in semiconductors, and that's, they're trying to get that to change, and commodities. And so that's it. Everything else they run a surplus in. So when people say, well, who's going to take the yuan? You really don't have to say, well, who's going to take the yuan? You have to say the only people who are going to end up holding the yuan, you know, who's going to hold the yuan? There's only two groups of people that are going to end up conceivably holding yuan based on trade flows, semiconductor exporters and commodity exporters. And so let's set aside semiconductors, because I think the non-de-dollarization people have a very valid point. I think given American and South Korean and European preeminence and the scattering of those supply chains, it's unlikely that they're going to get a lot of traction moving that to yuan. Agreed. Set that aside. Commodities, though, Saudi, Russia, Venezuela, Iran, Argentina, Australia, UAE, they're all doing deals in yuan. The last time I updated it was 2018, but I did a table for our clients showing the top 10 or 12 oil net exporters in the world. And then I just said, here's what they export on a net basis. And here are the deals they have signed with China, be they yuan deals, yuan swaps, yuan clearing, domestic production deals where they had, you know, refinery partnerships, whatever. And what I found was that in 2018, 96% of global oil net exports, as measured by these top 10 or 12 producers, had deals with China already in place. So the answer is the commodity people will take yuan. Okay, well, what are they going to do with the yuan? They tend to be underdeveloped countries. And so the first thing they're going to do with the yuan is buy Chinese goods. China's the factory of the world. And here, too, this is a real mind twister, and it's part of the reason why some people are having a really hard time seeing it, is they are still looking at this through the lens, and they're going, okay, if we assume someone's going to take the yuan, which we don't think they are, but they are, the commodity people, then, okay, let's pretend they do. Then what are they going to do? And they're thinking in terms of, well, they have to buy bonds and they have to buy stocks and they have to buy, you know, whatever. And no, they don't. And they're not. What they're doing is they are buying Chinese goods. And it turns out Chinese is the factor of the world. And 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, it was cheap plastic trinkets. Now it's Huawei 5G. It's really high level. You know, they're moving up the value chain. You can see that clearly everywhere. And so you can see the trade arrangement evolving to commodity producers taking yuan, recycling some of those yuan into Chinese goods. Again, a virtuous cycle of trade that betters the lives of citizens on both sides of that trade in terms of improving living standards. And then if Saudi still has gold left over, or excuse me, yuan left over, Russia still has yuan left over, they can recycle it into gold that, as I mentioned before, rises over time in yuan terms, so that when they do need to spend, their purchasing power is maintained or grown in yuan terms to buy more stuff from China. And so when you lay it out like that, you realize, oh my gosh, this is a virtuous cycle of trade. It makes perfect sense. And it's great for basically the whole world, except for treasury bonds, which start piling up on domestic shores, because though that was our biggest export from 1980 to 2014, the biggest export in America by far were treasury bonds. It was two times bigger than anything else we exported over that time. And now exports, you know, our biggest export is piling up on our docks because it's not needed as much if you shift trade away on the margin as reserves, if you shift trade away on the margin.
Well, it's fascinating, right? Because we've seen the headlines and the acceleration in central bank buying of gold, you know, which happens at the same time this is happening, is, you know, it's hard to call it coincidental. But even if you think it's coincidental, it doesn't matter. It means there are price insensitive buyers for 152% more gold this year than they bought last year, right? Which is one thing. We've seen the Saudis talking about building a refinery in China to refine the oil, which is another, as you point out, a great way to recycle some of those renminbi. So you even shared with me a quote from Larry Summers, you know, about doing business with these guys. And it's such a great quote. I'm going to let you do it because I don't want to steal your thunder. You found the quote. So talk me through that in terms of this whole how we recycle our renminbi.
Yeah. Larry Summers said 2 weeks ago that a developing market official told him what we get from the Chinese is an airport. What we get from the Americans is a lecture. And this is your former Treasury Secretary. And you know, I don't always agree with him, but he tends to be blunt. And so it's very interesting. That ultimately is, hey, you need to do this. Your domestic politics need to do that. This, and the Chinese just show up and go, hey, you have yuan. You want an airport? We'll recycle it into airport and we'll employ some local people, will employ some of our people, and we'll buy the commodities, and your living standard raises, our living standard raises. It's a very virtuous cycle of trade. And China doesn't lecture them on their politics, and the other country doesn't lecture China on China's politics.
This brings us nicely to the one area of this where I think you and I have a disagreement in terms of what's happening. And that is, for me, the acceleration in this particular dynamic happened around this time last year, and when we started this podcast, when the Treasury froze those Russian central bank assets. You know, to me, that was the beginning, and I wrote and I said at the time that if you're a central bank governor now, you are duty-bound to find an alternative to holding your reserves in dollars, because you just can't take the risk that this could happen to you down the line because you make a decision that the US doesn't agree with, and consequently, we are going to see central banks all around the world looking for alternatives to the dollar. It doesn't mean they're going to get rid of them all, but they're going to hold as few in dollars as they need to rather than as many as they can. And that's a big, big difference. I thought at the time that was just a catastrophic policy error on behalf of the US. I heard rumblings from people that the Treasury made that decision and didn't involve the Fed. That was a Treasury and White House decision. It wasn't involving the Fed. I found it hard to believe at the time. I find it less hard to believe now, but still, it was a rumor rather than anything else, even though it was a credible one. I know you think differently. I know you think that this perhaps isn't a catastrophic policy error and a mistake. So talk through the way you look at this, because even though I don't think I agree with it, I need to think more about it, but it's a really interesting perspective.
Yeah, so the short version of it is I have heard credible rumblings that we agree that I heard the Fed wasn't even consulted.
Okay.
I think Powell said that. Powell was asked last year in like February or March, what do you think about this? And he said, I wasn't consulted.
Oh, so okay. Good.
I believe that's the case. So if we take him at his word, he wasn't consulted. I have heard credible rumblings that Treasury did not want to do it. Pentagon did. And Pentagon got their way. And I think in terms of why, I got something that I wrote back in 2017, and it's out of a book, multiple excerpts of a book by Edward Luce, who's a writer at the FT. And I think he was actually Larry Summers' speechwriter. And he spent a lot of his life in America, and it's a great book. It's called Time to Start Thinking. It's an interview of American and global military, business, political, educational leaders. And the tone of the book is, America, I love you, but yes, you look fat in those jeans. And so when we, to tie it back to this conversation in terms of why I think Pentagon wanted it, let's go back to some quotes in this book. So these are conclusions of 16 high-ranking U.S. military officers who participated in a 2011 strategy session at the National Defense University. Okay, so here we go. This book was written in 2011 or 12. Quote, "The window on America's hegemony is closing. We are at a point right now where we still have choices. By 2021, we will no longer have choices. The U.S. is way too dependent on its military and should sharply reduce its global footprint by winding up all wars, notably in Afghanistan, and by closing peacetime military bases in Germany, South Korea, the U.K., and elsewhere. All this is a means to an end, which is to restore America's economic vitality. Our number one goal should be to restore American prosperity. As such, we recommend the Pentagon shrink its budget by at least 20%. Most of the savings would be spent on civilian priorities such as infrastructure, education, and foreign aid. Nobody here thinks the politics in this town are going to change overnight. All we're saying is that we're in trouble if they don't. This isn't about ideology. It is about understanding where we are as a country." That quote was followed in that same book by a quote by the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, quote, also 2011. "The number one threat facing America is its rising debt burden. This threat is greater than that posed by terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and global warming. We are borrowing money from China to build weapons to face down China. That is a broken strategy. It is a failed strategy from a national security perspective." And so as I've had this conversation with people, they tend to be surprised. Why would Pentagon do this? There is this overwhelming consensus that is dollar status post 71 equals military loves it, because it hasn't been true for a decade. You go to 2018, there was assessing the U.S. defense industrial base. There's an unclassified version, it's publicly available, published October 5th, 2018. And it's 128 or 48 pages looking at the U.S. defense industrial supply chain and how much of it is sole source to China, dual source to China, or in states of acute disrepair because they can't compete against Chinese state capitalism. And so they're on the verge of going bankrupt, and that part of the supply chain for the U.S. military breaking down. And so when you take a step back and realize, it is crystal clear to me, the military has known for a long time it needs to reshore. Let me read one more that I think is really good. I wrote this in the February 2nd, 2017 report for clients as well. There were Captain Porter and Colonel Michaelby had something called the National Strategic Narrative, also cited by Luce in this report. I called up the report. "Even in a land as rich as ours, we too have seen the gradual breakdown of rural communities, rapid expansion of our cities. We've experienced migration, crime, domestic terrorism. We are struggling with joblessness. We are losing our traditional role of innovation dominance in leading edge industries and sciences. Fair trade, fair competition, a new narrative on trade. We have to focus first and foremost on investing our resources domestically in those national resources that can be sustained, such as our youth and our national resources. The domestic foundations of our national strength are crumbling. Many of us have forgotten that rewards must be earned. There is no free ride. Fair competition and hard work bring with them the true sense of accomplishment." If I wrote that, I would be called anti-American. In fact, I have written them, and I have been called anti-American. Yet, at the very highest levels of the U.S. Pentagon for over a decade, it has been well understood that all of this is happening. And so if they understood that for a decade, it is a very, very small leap to go from what is causing this. We go back to the argument of the de-dollarization people, Well, no one wants to run the deficits to supply. The military understands that running the deficits is doing this. So in other words, the dollar is killing America. The dollar is killing the defense industrial base. So we don't want to end the dollar, but what is really killing the defense industrial base is the primary reserve asset being treasuries. We have to run the deficits to create the debt, to make the debt our biggest export. So if you want to fix everything they've been talking about for a decade plus, what do? You have to put a bullet in the credibility of the treasury market as the primary reserve asset. How do you do that? You convince the president to tell every nation on the planet, we're going to take your money if you keep storing your reserves there. Take your business elsewhere. And that's Pandora's box. That can't be reclosed. That's over. And so now we're seeing this shift to gold. It's going to be inflationary. It's going to be bad for the dollar in a trade value perspective. But that doesn't mean the dollar is less dominant. Don't confuse the dominance of the dollar with the price of the dollar. Just because the price of the dollar goes down doesn't mean the dollar is no longer reserve currency. It just means the dollar is going to be cheaper in international trade markets as a result of these changes over time, as the Fed has to buy all these deficits with printed money. Side note. And as the dollar falls, we can actually begin reshoring. We can actually rebuild the defense industrial base. We can rebuild a middle class. We can reduce the political tensions that are reaching a fevered pitch in this country. All of that feeds off of one simple move, which is freeze Russia's FX reserves. Take your business elsewhere. We don't want to store your surpluses anymore. That deal is over.
You know, it's fascinating. And I say, I'm still far more inclined to ascribe foolishness to it than any great intent. But, you know, unlike a lot of people who will just say, ah, Luke, that's rubbish. I need to think some more about that. Because look, it all adds up. All this stuff comes together. But whichever way you look at it, whatever the reason for that, whether it was just sheer dumb policymaking or something calculated, the outcome is exactly the same, right? Less people wanted to hold treasury bonds as opposed to dollars. So let's talk about what that means for the US's finances. Because when you talk about the need to put a bullet in the treasury market, that may well be a need, but finding the way to put the bullet in it so that it dies a slow and peaceful, quiet death is a very difficult thing to do, right? I mean, what does this mean for US finances, and how do you possibly manage an exit from the treasury market?
Global central banks stopped buying treasuries on net in 2014. China said in 2013, a decade ago, we're done buying. We're not buying them. Yeah. Said it's no longer in China's interest to grow FX reserves. Okay. From that moment on, China's still running the surpluses in dollars that they get from the existing, pre-existing status quo dollar system. But what are they doing with them? Instead of financing us, they're leaving us to finance us. And they're going around using the dollars to buy up refineries and oil fields and copper mines and build a military, build a navy. Like, it's the only Cold War in history where we're paying for our military and we're paying for China's military too. It's the silliest thing in the world. So they had 9 years of that, right? Or 8 years of that they did that. So to be clear, by the time this change happened last year, we said, take your business elsewhere. This was a response. We are no longer going to allow the Chinese to use the dollar system against us. This is just marking to market something that had already happened. So with that as context, let's talk through what it implies, right? So from 1975 to 2014, by far and away, the US's biggest export were treasury bonds. So we're no longer exporting treasury bonds as of 2014. These things start piling up on our shores, and you can see a very methodical, you know, we're going to regulate banks into buying treasuries. We're going to regulate money market funds into buying treasuries. We're going to try to cut deficits a little bit with Obamacare. We are going to, repo rate spike. Oh, Fed has to grow the balance sheet. Nope. Okay, good. Oh, COVID, Fed can grow the balance sheet a lot. Okay, we're going to try to QT. We're going to tighten rates. Oh, oops. You know, we have this crisis, that crisis. Fed's growing the balance sheet again. Banks are selling again. So you can see, if you look at it from almost a manufacturing perspective, a supply chain perspective, there's been you're making widgets, and your foreign buyers of widgets stop buying them. And so now you've been trying to sort of stuff widgets and turn off the supply chain. You can't turn off the line, right? It's like the I Love Lucy thing, right? Where the line is still going with the chocolates and she's trying to stuff them in her mouth. Well, like the bank regulations of HQLA, that was like, you know, the Treasury trying to stuff Treasury bonds in Lucy's mouth. And money market fund reforms where they mandated more Treasury holdings, stuff some Treasury bonds in Lucy's mouth. And ultimately, they have two choices. They've got to slash spending, which they can't because over 100% of tax receipts are entitlements, defense, and interest. And paradoxically, by trying to reduce inflation, Powell's made the problem worse because interest expense is way higher than it was when he started this process. Or the Fed ultimately has to grow their balance sheet. They basically have to go to a war footing like we did in World War II, which is the Fed's going to buy it all at some cap rate and they're going to let the dollar go. They're going to let inflation go. And we're going to have some version of industrial policy to reshore things. And that's the end game. And that I have extremely high conviction in. What I have no conviction in is Powell willing to fly the plane into the ground, insisting that the federal government cut spending before he relents and has to finance it all. And that I have no view on, but that's, you know, it's entirely possible. He just says, listen, I'm going to QT this whole time. And he's willing to let Treasury auctions fail. He's willing to let the US government default. And then all bets are off. It's bad for risk. But ultimately, if we think about this production line of Treasuries that does not stop, in fact, it just goes faster and faster and faster because the debt goes faster and faster and the deficits get bigger and bigger as they raise rates trying to fight the inflation. Lucy only has so much room and around for chocolates. And the chocolates in this case are the Treasuries. And once that's full, either the chocolates spill out, the Treasury bonds spill out, and the price of Treasuries fall, rates go up, and then we go into a debt spiral. Or Uncle Jerome comes in, and he's got a big bucket to put all the chocolates in, and it's called his balance sheet, and it's called QE, and he buys them all, and he sets the price, and we're in what yield curve control. And the U.S. delevers the same way it did after World War II when its debt was this high, which is real rates go to negative 15% for a few years. Bondholders get killed on a real basis. Thank you for your donation to the reshoring of America. The American defense industrial base, gold finishes at probably 10 grand and, you know, we move on. It's happened over and over around the world.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, right? There's plenty of precedent for this. It may dressed up differently in each time, but there's plenty of precedent for this. And you know, it's going to be interesting to see what Wade DeSantis does now that he's in charge of the BOJ, because I suspect he's going to have a moment coming where he's faced with the back end of this, right? How do we exit yield curve control without creating a massive amount of instability? But you talked there about the deficits, and we saw in the first half of the year, obviously, the budget deficit climbed over $1 trillion. And that caught a lot of people by surprise. It wouldn't have caught anyone that reads your work by surprise. But talk a little bit about that and the importance of that deficit coming in where it did and what that means for all the stuff we've kind of talked about in the first 45 minutes of this conversation.
Sure. So it just accelerates the pressure, right? That 1.1 trillion in no small part because Powell increased interest expense dramatically and reduced tax receipts pretty notably by virtue of what he did with rates. It just accelerates the conveyor belt of chocolates. Now they've got to place $1.1 trillion. You know, there's been this conversation. I tweeted about it yesterday. Hey, are we going to have a recession? And I knew whatever the New York Fed recession indicators, the highest since 82. And this indicator, when it gets to this high, we have a recession. And I don't know if it's a yield curve base or what it is, because obviously there's a lot of mixed signals on it. But the point I made is the last three recessions, deficits have gone up 6% of GDP, 8% of GDP, 12% of GDP, 2001, 2008, 2020, peak to trough in terms of the deficit. 6% of our GDP is 3.7 trillion. Right now, we're running $1.1 trillion for a half a year, so 2.2, right? So 2.2 plus, you know, if you increase that by 6%, I mean, right now we're at 8% of GDP. So you'd be looking at 14% to 20%, right? 8% plus 12%, 8% plus 6%. If we have a recession, you're going to have a deficit probably anywhere of 14 to 20% of GDP. That's on 26 trillion, 4 trillion to 6 trillion bucks, 4 trillion to 5.2 trillion. Powell's still selling $1.2 trillion. That's, you know, $95 billion a month in QT in theory. So, you know, let's throw another, that's 5.2 to 6.6. Okay, now foreigners, as we saw last year, in a U.S. recession, a U.S. slowdown, the dollar goes up, they have to sell treasuries. They have in total $7.4 trillion for sale. Let's say they just sell $1 trillion of them. Now you're at 6.2 to 7.6 trillion. That's who's the buyer? And oh, by the way, the banks, which were buyers from 14 to 20, are going to be having credit issues. And we're already seeing that what happened in 1Q when they tried to sell treasuries. So let's say they sell $500 billion. You're looking at net supplies in a recession anywhere from $7 trillion to, what did I say? $8.5 trillion?
Eight and change, yeah. Yeah.
And so the answer is, of course, well, they'll force people who own stocks to sell stocks. Stocks will crash and houses will crash and they'll buy treasuries. But if they do that, the deficit number is going to get bigger, because the only reason the deficit number is as low as it is, even at the widening, is because stocks are as high as they are. You get into this debt death spiral. So they just, any recession accelerates this machinery. It accelerates the conveyor belt of treasury chocolates into not enough, you know, loosies to take them down. It accelerates the crisis and this pace at which Powell's going to have to show up and buy them all. And by way of your point before, look, the Japanese have $3 trillion in net assets over here. One way they can get out of their yield curve control is just say, Jerome, I'm sorry, I'm taking my $3 trillion and I'm going home. Mm-hmm. And as they repatriate that, they can get out of yield curve control, maybe not permanently, but for a while, by financing their own deficits at a market rate. But that then accelerates our chocolate conveyor belt, right? Now it's spinning even faster because our assets are leaving. So this supply-demand dynamic gets for treasury bonds is already out of hand structurally, based on the bad ideas in the Middle East, the bailouts, entitlements that were promised decades ago, and those are growing secularly. Then Powell accelerated them further with rate hikes, and they can accelerate further with foreign repatriations. And then this overall de-dollarization of the global commodity trade just spins on this even faster.
You know, what's really interesting to me is there are so many people who say the U.S. debt situation is absolutely untenable. And yet it feels like they have to get the correct reason for it to finally matter. You know what I mean? It's like there are so many different reasons this could all go pear-shaped. And what you've laid out is a really credible one. To a lot of people, it won't be. They'll go, oh, no, that's not the way it's going to happen. I completely disagree with that. It's going to end a different way. I mean, it doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, I think we all know it's untenable. But let's finish with energy, because it's such a key component of all this. And energy's place in this kind of multidimensional chess game that we're talking about has been evident for a long, long time. It's been crucial, really, for the entire time the world has existed on oil. But lately, it seems to be entirely misunderstood by people. And that is this concept that you've coined about peak cheap energy. Because, you know, peak energy, peak oil is a concept that we've had floating around for a long, long time now. But this idea of peak cheap energy is such an important distinction to make. Explain what you mean by that for anyone that doesn't understand it, and then explain peak cheap energy's role in all of this, because it's more an accelerant than anything else.
Exactly. So peak cheap oil is just simply, we're not running out of oil, but we're running out of cheap oil. So, and we can see this in spades, right? Is Saudi conventional oil is very cheap, Russian, et cetera, and U.S. shale, which has been 90% of global oil production growth over the last decade, is expensive and getting more expensive. And so this concept of an increasing marginal cost of oil in particular, energy more broadly, because a version of the same dynamic is happening sort of in gas, but definitely in things like copper and iron ore, et cetera, is that it acts as another incentive not to store your FX reserves in debt. In other words, if you are China, under the post-71 system, the way this works is you're going to hold dollars, only dollars, as your reserves. And oil is going to be priced in only dollars. And the problem that peak cheap energy introduces, and not only dollars, but only treasury bonds, right? Let's just say in U.S. dollar debt. So we know a treasury bond, the rate goes up and down, the price goes up and down. But generally speaking, let's just use a $1,000 face value, because generally the coupon, other than the 70s, doesn't move around much. And at any rate, the U.S. government can't afford the 70s coupons, not even close. So the $1,000 face value, you've got trillions of these things sitting around. And that's great, $30 per barrel oil. That's awesome. $40 a barrel, $50 a barrel, $80 a barrel. Peak cheap energy, we're replacing $10 Saudi oil with $80, $90 marginal, incremental marginal shale oil. Well, now your trillions of $1,000 face value treasury bonds have gone from buying you a lot of oil at $10 Saudi oil to not enough oil to run your economy at $80 oil. And so you would have to be, and what happens then is you're going to run down your surpluses, right? So or your reserves faster. You're going to run out of dollar treasury bonds to buy $90 oil really fast because the price is going up and because your consumption is going up. Chinese oil consumption is like, you just take a ruler. It is like up and it continues to go up. And critically, despite the fact that China's already by far the world's biggest oil importer, their per capita oil consumption is 1/5 the United States. India's is 1/15 the United States. And these are 35% of the world's population, those two countries. So if you're China, you're going, okay, in a dollar-based world, post-71 status quo, I've got a pile of dollars, $1,000 a clip per bond, and I see the price of oil. I'm replacing $10 reserves with $90 reserves, and I'm only using 1/5 per capita the Americans do. And India over there is only using 1/15, and we're growing our economies. We're growing our, oh my God. In this system, I'm going to run out of dollars. And when I run out of dollars, I'm going to have a 1997 Southeast Asia crisis, which I had a front row seat to. And the yuan's going to collapse. Inflation's going to spike. All of the progress I have made over the last 60 years is going to implode. The Chinese Communist Party's credibility is going to implode. And I could be torn to pieces personally. So this I cannot allow to happen. And it's fascinating. You go back, you know, Kyle Bass laid out this case, this, hey, China imports more oil. It's only in dollars. Price goes up. They're going to run out of dollars. They're going to devalue the yuan. He was exactly right. So for China, and I think this is really misunderstood, peak cheap energy, peak cheap oil means everything we talked to earlier in the show is not necessarily China act as an aggressor. This is a defensive move. China will collapse if this happens. Now, to be clear, Lehman had an $800 billion balance sheet. When it collapsed, it nearly collapsed the financial system. China has a $37 trillion balance sheet. So there are people listening to this going, oh, good, we should collapse China. No, that's a stupid idea. Because if you think like the whole world isn't going to friggin' end, no, by the way, if the $37 trillion balance sheet implodes, the only thing you're going to want to own is gold anyway. So like, no, it's not a good idea. So peak cheap energy accelerates the incentive for China to do exactly what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, which is price energy in their own currency, offer up gold settlement, reduce the amount of treasury bonds they need to hold in reserve by virtue of doing this. Robin Brooks at the IIF had a great chart in 2018. It showed that if China did all of their commodity trade just in yuan, their trade surplus would increase by $800 billion a year. So if they just put 10% of their commodity trade into yuan, their dollar liquidity increases by about $100 billion. I'm assuming they're spending $1 trillion a year now. And more from there. That gives them this dollar liquidity flexibility. It reduces their need to hold dollars. And if this was happening, you would expect to see China's FX reserves as a percent of GDP decline over time. And sure enough, in 2013, China's FX reserves were 46% of GDP. They're down to 18%. And I think they're going way lower, which again, throws it back over to the US side of like, uh-oh, the chocolate conveyor belt of treasuries that, you know, Lucy's going to need to eat, you know, is going to spin faster. So peak cheap energy is really just an accelerant by virtue of its importance in the balance of payments of China, India, Japan, Europe, and on the other side, Russia, Saudi, right? Saudi can't afford to hold treasuries, you know, swap a bunch of oil for a bunch of treasuries and then, you know, have their wells go dry. And then they're sitting on a bunch of treasuries whose value collapses against oil when they've got to go back out and buy oil. It makes no sense for them or Russia to do that. So that's why I think you're seeing Saudi go to gold, see Russia go to gold, is gold moves with oil. Gold can move more than oil. And that's peak cheap energy is just accelerating this whole dynamic that we've discussed.
Well, it's fascinating to watch Singapore buy 50-odd tons of gold in the first 2 months of the year. I mean, Singapore, that's crazy. I mean, that's more than China. That's more than Russia. You know, something's clearly going on. And whether this is happenstance, coincidence, or enemy action, unfortunately, we're at the point now where defense becomes offense, because what you have to do defensively is simultaneously an offensive move against the other side of the table. And look, Yellen gave a big speech this week, which was reported, and she talked about multipolarity and this idea of a multipolar world. is very much in the fore. And Yellen's speech, Marko Papić posted it on Twitter. It was a fascinating speech to read. I'm not sure if you read it or not. I'll send you the link after we finish talking. But it was very much the steel fist inside the velvet glove. And it's very clear that this idea of multipolarity is all fine and good as long as it's on our terms. And, you know, it's obvious that any move to multipolarity comes because those terms don't work anymore. And that feels like the place we're at here now is this doesn't really work for anybody, including the US, if you're right about the Pentagon. So how do we get from the current global monetary order, the current global monetary system, to whatever comes next without a major, major, major dislocation? And the more I look at this stuff and the more stuff of yours I read and the more stuff I read from elsewhere, the more difficult it seems to me to do that smoothly and efficiently without causing an enormous amount of turmoil.
That's the scariest part of all this. And it's historically, you've not had these big monetary transitions without a major war. The US has never gone to war with a nuclear power, right? So you've got, you know, this has never happened without a war. The US has never gone to war with a nuclear power. Which of these two things is going to happen? I don't know. As a father of three sons, two of draft age already, I hope it's not a war. The other thing within this is, to me, it sets up as an investor, and it's fascinating to me. There was a chart in the FT a while back, maybe a month or so ago, about bonds. And I've not liked long-term bonds for a long time, especially long-term sovereign debt. I think it's all risk with no return, no reward. But I didn't realize that from 1900 to 1981, real returns on bonds were negative the whole time on average. They were certificates of confiscation for 81 years. And 82 to 2021, they were good. And then they were shit last year. And everyone's like, okay, woo, 1 year, we're back. We're back to this 40-year trade. And I'm looking at this going, what you just laid out, I'm like, okay, on one side, we get a transition to a currency system, which means that bondholders get killed on a real basis for like either all right away, like 2-3 years of 100% inflation, or 5 or 8 years of 10 to 20% inflation, while they're capped at whatever, lose. Or we have a war, which some people say, war's gonna have a war. Like, show me which bonds you want to own in a war. Like, you understand that a major war between the US and Russia or US and China results in hyperinflation instantly. Like, every financial asset I own will be sold and I will be out shopping at Target trying to just buy stuff that isn't bolted down before it starts. Like, they will be rationing stuff so fast that when you go to buy it at the rack with your ration coupon, it ain't going to be the price you see on the screen today. So within all this, and like I said, I hope it's not a war. I really do. I'm optimistic that the mutually assured destruction standpoint of the tens or hundreds of millions that'll die if it goes to war because everyone's got nukes is enough to ensure the peaceful transition. With that said, to me, I look around and I see things like the 60-40 portfolio, what I've called the 60-40-0 portfolio in America, right? 60% equities, 40% bonds, 0% gold. It is staggering to me that the average investor owns 0% gold and physical at that point. Because to be clear, a lot of the unallocated gold that you have is no different than cash, right? Your paper gold is just the obligation of a bullion bank in extremis. And we all know since 08 that in extremis, bullion bank is just an obligation of the Fed, you know, just like a Federal Reserve note. So paper gold is just dollars. So you got to own physical if you're going to do it. But like, I look at this and go, heads bonds lose, tails bond lose, heads gold wins, tails bond. And it's so obvious to me. And it's such a variant perception. And like, nobody has the trade on. It is the most incredible thing to me that I've seen in this business in a long time.
Well, I think a large part of that is because we've had 40 years when you didn't need to own it. And that's a hard habit to break. You know, in the 70s, nobody had a problem owning gold, right? It was a very normal allocation to have to a portfolio. And that time will come again, I'm sure. It'll be too late for most people. But that mindset will change. Listen, mate, we started this conversation a year ago. It continues and it will continue into the future. And I'm so grateful for every chance I get to sit and talk about this stuff with you, because it's so interesting. If nothing else, it's interesting to think all these possibilities through. And while we don't know how this will play out, I feel like a lot of things we're talking about are going to matter. So continuing to have the conversation about them and continuing to try and finesse and update how we think this roadmap is going to play out is incredibly helpful. So, mate, thank you again for taking this time. And before we wrap up, for anyone listening to this that isn't familiar with your work and where to find it, please let them know, because I've said this before, long before we did this podcast, but anyone not reading your work is doing themselves a great disservice, particularly now.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's the easiest way to find me is at fftt-llc.com for information about our institutional and mass market products. And they can find me on Twitter, as probably everybody knows, at Luke Groman, L-U-K-E-G-R-O-M-E-N.
Perfect. My friend, love to the family, and I will see you soon.
That sounds great. Likewise, my friend.
Take care. Well, my thanks to Luke for another fascinating hour and change. And as always, my thanks to you for listening. If you weren't out there listening, it would just be me and Luke talking to ourselves, which is fine by me, but the more the merrier, I think. Anyway, that's it for me for another show. I will be back again with another conversation in the very near future. Thanks very much for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.